The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Coming up here in just a bit, we're going to be going live to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal, to update us on some interesting developments down in Israel, particularly in the north of Israel. And then also on today's show, coming up in the second segment, we'll be talking about a world in revolt. Yesterday on the program, if you caught the last half, we talked about just so many of the miracles of the 1800s and the rise in power and influence and wealth of the great British Empire and of course the United States of America. But we're seeing over the past 100 years, we're seeing a lot of changes in the other direction. And this, too, of course, is prophesied, and we'll point you to some fascinating quotes by Herbert Armstrong and try to give just an overall snapshot of what has happened following World War I, the 100 years that followed the end of that so-called Great War. Well, today, Israel has launched an offensive to destroy Hezbollah attack tunnels right on its northern border, and Israel hasn't done anything like this at the Israeli-Lebanon border for more than a decade. So it's going to be interesting to watch what Hezbollah does in response. Hezbollah, of course, is backed by Iran, and there always is with this kind of thing. There's a chance that it could very well escalate into a serious conflict. Last night, the IDF, that's the Israeli Defense Forces, they tweeted out, "We have just launched Operation Northern Shield to expose and neutralize cross-border attack tunnels dug by Hezbollah from Lebanon to Israel." And then they had a video that accompanied this tweet that included text which read, "Hezbollah has spent years digging cross-border attack tunnels between Lebanon and Israel as part of their offensive plan that Hezbollah calls conquering the Galilee." And so for more on this, we're going to go over to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal. Brent, greetings.
Hello.
It's good to hear from you again. You're, of course, a regular on Trumpet Hour, and you have your own radio program as well, but we don't get to talk to you as much on this show, so it's good to catch up. How's the family, by the way?
Family's doing well. My son is 9 months, and he's just started walking around the apartment now, so he's going to be difficult to catch up with very soon.
Exciting times at the Noctegal household there in Jerusalem. Well, maybe you could start by telling us about these tunnels. The IDF keeps stressing, as do many of these reports we're seeing today, that these are offensive tunnels. These are meant for Hezbollah to go on offense. What do they mean by that?
Right. So as you did mention, Hezbollah has this goal. It's a stated goal of theirs for about 4 or 5 years. Their head, Hassan Nasrallah, said that he does want to take over the Galilee, and he's planned to send a lot of his Hezbollah fighters that are based mainly in southern Lebanon across the border into Israeli territory under the cover of a massive barrage of missiles. And when we talk about Hezbollah, we do talk mostly about their missile threat to Israel, because that is just absolutely massive. They've got over 100,000, around 130,000 missiles, many of them that can reach anywhere in Israel, and now kind of with this precision-guided technology. And so that's a very dangerous threat. And they were going to combine that, or they've said they're going to combine that with a ground offensive, with people crossing the border, their fighters crossing the border into Israeli territory through these tunnels. Now, these are tunnels that are similar to ones that Hamas kind of uses from the Gaza Strip, that we've seen them use Israel destroy the Hamas's terror tunnels before, but not from we haven't seen Israel destroy these ones or even locate these ones before. Apparently, today's mission is the culmination of 2.5 years of intelligence to spy out these tunnels. And when we say tunnel, we don't mean just a little 3 meters or 12 feet under the ground tunnel through sand. The one that was located today was 80 feet down, and it was 2 meters, 6 feet wide, 6 feet tall. It ran for 200 meters. It ran 40 meters or 120 feet into Israeli territory. It was carved through solid rock. So just this is a massive amount of effort has gone into creating these. And this is just the first one that the IDF has declared that they've found today.
Is that the one that is right outside of Matula?
Yeah, close to there.
Yeah, Matula, this is a city right at the northern border. It's kind of up in the hills, and you can look north from Matula and see all of these villages there in southern Lebanon. We've been there several times over the years. We spent the night there once, in fact, and I think taped a TV program just trying to find a good location that was right at the border. And I remember even years ago when you know, hostilities had died down and it was relatively peaceful. I remember at the time when we stopped at a little convenience store in Matula thinking, boy, it wouldn't take much for it. All they have to do is cut through one of the fences somewhere. I know the Israelis obviously monitor those fences very carefully, but still, it's happened before down south with Gaza, and you get a few gunmen to come into that little community. And you just, you could see how a whole city or a whole region could be terrorized with just one incident.
Oh, for sure. And Matula, it's actually right now as a precaution, that town has been cut off from tourists or anyone that doesn't live there. It's under military rule basically right now, just in case Hezbollah does decide that it's going to counter this, because you can foresee Hezbollah being very upset by this, considering that they have worked for so long on these tunnels. And so Israel, right now, it doesn't know whether Hezbollah hasn't received intelligence that Hezbollah is going to push back with its missiles, but they may, and those orders will likely come from Iran.
Yeah, let me just play for you and the audience here. This is, I think this was just an hour or two ago from an IDF spokesman situated in Matula. This is what he had to say, clip four.
Hezbollah has been digging from within civilian facilities under the border, under the blue line, and have effectively created a tunnel that leads into Israel. Now, they've been trying to hide their efforts behind civilian infrastructure, and they have been doing this for quite a few years. We, the IDF, have been on their tails. And for the last 4 years, we have been monitoring their activity, following what they have been doing quite closely. And today, we launched the operation, which has a very clear aim. We are operating on the Israeli side of the blue line, so not inside Lebanese territory, with a very clear and simple aim of finding these cross-border attack tunnels and destroying them so that Israeli civilians in Matula and other places around the border are safe and can go about their daily lives.
That's an IDF spokesman there at the northern border of Israel, where it borders Lebanon. And as we explained right before the clip, they've already located one, as Brent was explaining, just how deep it is, how long it runs, putting this city, Matula, and the entire northern region in danger. I think one thing as an aside here that is always fascinating to watch when Israel does this kind of thing, and most people ignore it, I know, but they are really good at communicating what they're doing, why they're doing it, why they have to do it. And what's always astounding to me is that here, Jerusalem, I think it has the most journalists of any city in the world. You've got all these international journalists from the New York Times, from BBC, from Reuters, from the Associated Press. And something like this, they're not that interested in it. It takes the Israeli Defense Forces to go on Twitter, to go out to the world to try to, and you've seen stories before where the Prime Minister himself will go on TV in the hope that it will just get some attention. This kind of thing should get a lot more attention than it does. But sadly, it doesn't get attention until Israel finally does retaliate, which, as Brent was bringing out there, this has been something that's been in the works for years now. Now, yesterday, where did he meet? It was Prime Minister Netanyahu meeting with Secretary of State Pompeo somewhere in Europe. And do you suppose that this had anything, or that what they're doing today had anything to do, or was it discussed in that meeting yesterday, Brent?
It was discussed. The Jerusalem Post was reporting earlier that it definitely was discussed, Israel's plans to start this mission. Of course, Israel has received more favor from this U.S. administration than any other as far as its relationship or its activities against Iran. Israel has virtually been given a green light by the U.S. to fire on Iran in Syria when they're trying to arm it through. We're trying to arm Hezbollah through arms convoys and such. And so Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in, I think it was Brussels, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made an unannounced trip there to meet with him and just see that the Americans were fine with this. And they received the full go-ahead from the United States, which is something that's very nice for Israel. Because Israel, as you said, and as you kind of alluded to, it doesn't just fight a war against Hamas or Hezbollah or Iran. It has to worry about world public opinion. And to have the United States on its side is as a firm backer, supporting it in such places as the UN and other international bodies. It does give Israel more of a green light to act before the whole world pile-on begins when Israel does such military activities.
Right, and you were saying earlier, too, that this operation, while they might have waited for the U.S. to give the go-ahead, it's been an operation that's been in the works for a number of years. And as this IDF spokesman went on to explain, that's because of some dramatic changes that have been taking shape in within Hezbollah. Here's one more clip from the IDF spokesman from just a couple of hours ago, clip 5.
A big change occurred in 2012 when the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, proclaimed that he has a plan to conquer the Galilee. That's what they call it. The plan is quite simple. Massive amounts of fire to be fired from Lebanon by Hezbollah towards the line of contact, towards the immediate area by the border. And an additional part of the plan, the surprise factor, according to Hezbollah's plan, would be to have elite Hezbollah terrorists to come from Lebanon and to infiltrate into Israel and to try to surprise Israeli troops and, of course, to target Israeli civilians. That component is what we're talking about today. That is what Operation Northern Shield is all about. That is what we're exposing today, and that is what we're dealing with.
And you can see why they're taking it so seriously, because it's one thing to lob hundreds and hundreds of missiles into northern Israel, but if that's going off and then these terrorists are streaming through these tunnels, well, then Israel would have its hands full in a hurry. Well, we'll wait and see, as we discussed a moment ago, what the response might be from Hezbollah, as Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, said this morning. The most disturbing question is how Iran will react to or react in the future, and whether it will find a way to exact a price from Israel, perhaps on another border, for foiling its operational plans. Undertaking the tunnel project has been an expensive, secretive venture of critical importance to Iran and Hezbollah. It's clear that the Iranians have also been in the picture. So that's coming even from the left wing, Haaretz newspaper. Well, while you're here with us, Brent, maybe we've kind of sat on this story for a couple of weeks. This 2,000-year-old ring bearing the name Pontius Pilate's ring from the first century. And what can you tell us about this particular discovery?
Yeah, this is really interesting. It was a ring that was discovered or uncovered back in 1968 at Herodion, which I guess is about 20 kilometers south of Jerusalem, something like that. It's one of Herod the Great's, one of his great cities or great towns that he built up. Herod the Great living during the time of Jesus Christ's birth. His final life was right when Jesus Christ was born. He was the one that was responsible for trying to put Jesus Christ to death as a baby. But then if you fast forward about 30 years, the Romans were ruling over Judea at the time, and the governor for the Romans, he wasn't a Jew, he was an appointee from Caesar, by Caesar himself, to rule over the territory of Judea to ensure nothing could get out of hand, was Pontius Pilate. And he ruled from 26 to 36 AD, and right in the middle there is Jesus Christ's ministry. And what they found at Herodian back in 50 years ago was this ring that said Pilatus on it. But 50 years ago, they didn't really look at the importance of it or see it as, for whatever reason, they didn't publish it as being Pilate's ring. And so when excavations renewed at Herodian just the last couple of years, and now this finding, or whoever who's excavating, the archaeologist who's excavating Herodian said he wanted to re-look at this discovery, re-study it, let's see what if it really says Pilate. And indeed, they came out just last week and said, yes, this is the ring of a Pilate. We're not 100% sure that it's the same Pontius Pilate, but the fact that it is a seal or a ring with his name on it, and Pilate is a very rare name, and it dates to the right time period as well, this does look like it's a signet ring from that famous biblical governor of Judea.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. One thing that I read, it said that besides looking at it again or examining it again after 50-some years, as you said, I guess the technology today also was better, obviously, than it was back then. And it just made me think of the point we've made before about the advancements in archaeology. Just in the past 10 or 15 years, advancements that have really helped with our work in support of Dr. Eilat Mazar there at the City of David and on the Ophel. I mean, we really have benefited from some of these advancements to find more evidence. As you say, more and more of it is being uncovered. Well, it's been good to have Brent with us here today. We'll try to get in touch with him yet again in the near future, certainly if we see hostilities intensify there at the northern border of Israel. When we come back, we will, as I said at the top of the show, we'll get into the 100 years of revolt. Mr. Armstrong talked about the new morality, that pendulum swing from the old morality over to the new. He writes about it in The Missing Dimension in Sex, and also in God Speaks Out on the New Morality. And we've talked at length here in recent weeks about the 100-year anniversary of the end of World War I, and how that, as we'll cover in the next segment, how that really did trigger this immoral swing over to the new morality. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
And by the end of World War I, the United States and Great Britain owned and possessed more than two-thirds and almost three-fourths of all the great wealth, the cultivated wealth of all the world. And all the other nations, Russia with her billion people, I mean China with her billion, and India with nearly a billion, more than three-quarters of a billion people, and Russia, the third largest nation in the world, and Japan and Indonesia and others that are vast, that have vast populations, and all the nations of Europe, Germany and France, Spain, Portugal, Italy, all of the nations combined had only a little over one-fourth and less than a third of the wealth of the world, and our two nations possessed it. We had the sea gates of the whole world, and we're losing them. And Britain has already lost her world empire.
That's Herbert Armstrong speaking back in the 1980s about that fascinating history from the 1800s leading into the early part of the 20th century, and how that by the end of World War I, as he explained there, the U.S. and Britain possessed nearly three-fourths of the cultivated wealth of the world. You start adding up all the other nations, as he did there in that soundbite. It's astounding to think about the blessings of prosperity and wealth and power that God gave to our nations. And this was not happenstance. We didn't get it because of good old American ingenuity. God promised. God promised those blessings. They were part of the birthright promises made to Abraham, and then again to Isaac, and Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. And Jacob, whose name, Israel, was put upon those two lads, Ephraim and Manasseh. You think about all of those blessings, that astounding rise to power in the late 1800s and early 1900s. But then what happened? As he said there at the end, we're beginning to lose those sea gates, those blessings, and Britain's already lost the empire. Joel Hilliker wrote in his article from a few weeks back, one lesson of World War I, he said, in many ways, World War I was a defeat, not only for the Germans and the other Central Powers, but even for the nations that had subdued them, chief among them, the force that had dominated the globe for over a century, the British Empire. How could this be a defeat for Britain? He explains, when the armistice was signed on November 11, 1918, the world was a changed place. It is true that the British Empire emerged from Versailles with nearly a million square miles more territory, inhabited by some 13 million people. However, the empire would never recover from the wealth and manhood that it expended, the prestige it sacrificed, the love and loyalty of its peoples that it lost. It says World War I dealt the era of British dominance and stability a fatal blow. You think about all of that optimistic patriotism heading into World War I. Young Britons lining up in droves to support that war effort. And then so many of them coming home in despair, cynical, having witnessed such unfathomable carnage. More than 700,000 Britons died in the war. The war left 160,000 young English widows. The war left 300,000 children fatherless. Britain lost pretty much their best generation. These weren't young fighters that went from Sandhurst alone. They were joining up with the army from Oxford, from Cambridge. This was a different time, and certainly coming out of that war, it just accelerated the downward turn, morally. William Manchester, in his book, I've given this quote before, in Visions of Glory, he said the solid core, he's writing here about the Edwardian era, following the Victorian era. This is the first decade of the 1900s. Churchill, of course, grew up in the Victorian age. But in writing about these early years of the 1900s, Manchester said the solid core of agreed religious belief was gone. The Bible had lost its grip on Englishmen. People were groping for a substitute. The new vogues were popular psychology, pragmatism, and Nietzscheanism. Edwardians were bombarded by news of discoveries, glands, hormones, vitamins, genes, Einstein's E equals MC squared, Pavlovian conditioned reflexes, and the subconscious as revealed by Freud, Adler, and Jung. It says, fruits of inventive genius promised more excitement to come, but the cumulative effect of all this change, which should have broadened the human vision, gave men a sense of confinement and helplessness. You think about all of this technological advancement, all of this technology improving society, one would think. You would think it would broaden human vision. It didn't. This is the paradox that Herbert Armstrong wrote about so often. All of these advancements on the one hand, and yet these appalling evils on the other. Churchill, when he was a young politician in the early 1900s, he was writing about what a disappointment the 20th century had been to that point. This was after World War I. He looked at the first two decades and said, what a disappointment. Look at these disastrous events that have darkened the last 20 years. That's Churchill writing about 100 years ago. We have seen in every country a disillusion, a weakening of those bonds, a challenge to those principles, a decay of faith, an abridgment of hope on which structure and ultimate existence of civilized society depends. It's all beginning to unravel, Churchill said. He was writing about society at large, not just about one particular war or one event. Churchill said, I was a child of the Victorian era when the structure of our country seemed firmly set, when its position in trade and on the seas was unrivaled, and when the realization of the greatness of our empire and our duty to preserve it was growing ever stronger. But now, he said, all of that was being threatened from within. Now there's a sickness on the inside. Britons weren't as patriotic as they were going into World War I. They were losing their taste for empire, as Manchester wrote. And as Herbert Armstrong said many years later, following the end of that great war, we entered into a new time. We entered into the end time in The Missing Dimension in Sex. Here's what Mr. Armstrong said, writing about this time period and the years that followed. In the wake of World War I, he said, the agitation resulting from Freud's revolutionary conclusions finally brought about the toppling of the legal barriers, and the moral barriers began breaking down simultaneously. With the removal of legal restraints against sex instruction, medical doctors and psychoanalysts began grinding out volume after volume, imparting their heretofore banned instruction about sex. It says the world began throwing off the restraints. The revolt was on. The revolt against prudery, repression, and ignorance. The new sensual knowledge, with its most needed dimension missing, quickly began to be gulped in by curiosity-hungry minds. What a change! What a transformation! And it happened in the span of just a few short years. He says the young people of today have little awareness of the sex and family conditions in pre-war years. In fact, until 1914, there had been little basic change for some 4,000 years. But now, all of a sudden, here's this avalanche of sex knowledge. It's, of course, missing the most important knowledge of all. The missing dimension, as Mr. Armstrong called it. But he says here in his book, the prior to 1914 years were as different from today's world as day is from night. What a difference. We've talked about that 100-year anniversary, the armistice. November 11th, 1918. Here we are 100 years later, and a lot has changed. A lot has changed. Mr. Armstrong said it's not only a moral revolution, a revolution in government, in economics, in science and technology, in education, in labor standards, in social values, even in religion. He said it's shaken the whole world. We're living in a world in revolt in more ways than one. But to look at the breakdown of the family, the gross immorality, it really got started, so much of it, so much of this filth, it got started with that avalanche of sex literature and sex education that was published following World War I. And then it just accelerated after the Second World War. And today we think, even our teenagers, I suppose, think that we're wise in all of this sex knowledge and even sex experience. But oh, how woefully ignorant we are. The missing dimension. You're only going to find that in the missing dimension in sex and in Mystery of the Ages and in other works like that. Ron Fraser, the late Ron Fraser, he had an article, when was it, back in 2009, where he talked about this period between 1914 and 1945, the start of World War I to the end of World War II, and how that the whole fabric of society was unraveled during that time. You had this combination of three ideologies, communism, fascism, and Nazism, and then put that together with all of those fashionable theories like Mr. Armstrong wrote about, Darwinian evolution, Freudian psychology, German rationalism. We've written about that many times before. And of course, Friedrich Nietzsche, he was the late 1800s, a bizarre individual, if ever there was one. But these are the kinds of minds that are held up, Nietzsche and Freud and so on, even to this day. Mr. Armstrong, again, he said in The Missing Dimension that when Sigmund Freud reached his conclusions in the early 1900s, well, at first, and many people don't even know this history, but it was pretty much ridiculed at the start. But then over time, these bizarre reasonings came to be accepted as sophisticated, as intellectual, as the solution to the problems of the old morality. And the old morality had its problems. Mr. Armstrong explains all of that in The Missing Dimension in Sex. But to swing from the old morality way over to the new morality of anything goes, no laws, no restraints, it's like leaping from the frying pan into the fire, he said. World War I, that period, 1914 to 1918, and then the years that followed, those years completely transformed the course of this world, the course of the geopolitical order, the course of morality. It triggered a revolution in moral attitudes, social values. And this revolution, it's been going on now for 100 years. 100 years of the new morality. 100 years of a world in revolt. And look at us today. Are we much, much better off? Since 1918, or the years before that great struggle, look at the history, even in the Bible, Deuteronomy 8. I won't take the time to read through some of these verses, but God said there, you be careful once you get into that promised land, after all of that fighting and all the struggles that you encountered to get there, the tendency is to relax and to let down. Think about our nations, these two great nations, the United States and Britain in particular. Well, we won the war. We won the Great War. We won the Second World War. But we're losing in so many other ways. There was a post-war relaxation in morals, most especially. You saw that. When it's a time of trial and test, just like before World War II, people were streaming into the churches, praying, fasting. But then after that, all the wealth and the prosperity, the leftovers from the blessed age, and we've become a spoiled people. Our hope is in this world and the things of this world, the materialism of this world. The Apostle Paul wrote, if in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most miserable. Even if your hope is in Christ in the present only, it's still a hopeless existence. Dennis Leap had an article back in 2013 in The Trumpet, and he said here again, referring back to this difficult time of struggle and trial and test, that World War era, he said, because of the senseless slaughter of World War I, trench warfare, young men developed a spirit of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. This was a time of great social change in America and in the Western world. Many historians view the period around World War I as one of sharp moral decline. An American obsession with sex and pornography took root. Interest in science pushed religion off center stage. The theory of evolution rocked American religion to its core. What happened? What happened to us? If in this life only we have hope, we're going to end up miserable. You think about what Paul wrote there in that chapter, 1 Corinthians 15. He went on to say, and why stand we in jeopardy every hour? I protest by your rejoicing that I have in Christ Jesus our Lord. I die daily. I'm not going through the motions here. I didn't risk my life to espouse some great lie, Paul said. This is my life. What I'm preaching to you about the resurrection from the dead, the return of Christ. This is our hope. He fought among the beasts at Ephesus, it says in verse 32. But some were saying, like Dennis Leap said in that article, some were saying even in Paul's day, well, let's just eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. There's no real hope for the future. It says in verse 33, be not deceived. Evil communications corrupt good manners. In other words, it does matter what you do and with whom you do it. It does matter how we live. God is taking note. God is evaluating. Verse 34 says, awake to righteousness and sin not, for some have not the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. Some of them were going to sleep. And spiritual slumber always leads to veering off the course that God has set for us, whether it's in looking at our nations or at spiritual Israel today. Look at all of these earth-shaking social changes that happened. I gave you the statistics at the start. How many wives were left without husbands, and how many children following those great wars were left without fathers? And in the case of World War II, because so many of our boys left to fight in that effort, that battle against fascism, you had a lot of women that were heading into the workforce, and it was a noble effort at that time. It was quite a sacrifice. It's what needed to be done. for the sake of freedom and liberty. But then, well, when the war ended, they didn't leave those posts. And so the family was disrupted. In the Plain Truth magazine from 1984, it says here, in the 1930s, economic depression descended on the world. The Great Depression was caused by human greed for profits at the expense of others, for gain, beyond that which was honestly produced and earned. It says World War II intervened and temporarily lifted some nations from economic depression, but the curse of war ripped men from their families, and wives, for the first time in great numbers, flocked to work outside the home to aid the war effort. A post-World War II pattern was set for unprecedented numbers of mothers to leave their homes and children for jobs and careers, leaving more and more children lacking in proper maternal instruction and discipline. And so, after World War II, we didn't switch back to those pre-war norms. And again, there was a relaxation in morals. You had an explosion of growth among women in the workforce. In 1950, it was something like 26% of married women that worked outside the home. By the 1980s, it had shot up to 67%. Today, it's something like 75%. What happens when there are no parents at home to look after the little ones? What does the proverb say? A child left to himself will bring shame. Shame upon the mother, it says in Proverbs 29 and verse 15. How important is it to have the traditional family with a loving father and provider and a supportive mother, a helpmeet? How important is it for those children? In the third chapter of Proverbs, it says, "My son, forget not my law, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to you. Let not mercy and truth forsake you. Bind them about your neck. Write them upon the table of your heart. So shall you find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and men." It says, "Trust in God with all your heart, and lean not unto your own understanding." We're leaning to our own understanding. And of course, all of that's under the influence of the god of this world, Satan the devil, 2 Corinthians 4:4 and Ephesians 2:2. Mr. Armstrong wrote in the World Tomorrow book, he said, "Modern education trains students to earn a living in the professions, occupations, and vocations, but fails to teach them how to live. It commits the crime of developing the machine, but it fails to develop the man. In modern education, we find perpetuation of false values, the teaching of distorted history, warped psychology, perverted arts and sciences, worthless knowledge." He set out to change that with Ambassador College, at least in the church, teaching young people from all over the world how to live. Armstrong College continues in that most cherished tradition. And how important is it today? How much is it needed when you look at this world in Missing Dimension and Sex, and especially in the God Speaks Out and on the New Morality book? He talks a lot about how that the modernist religious movement, it hasn't helped the situation, not at all. Instead of fighting against this slide toward worldliness, instead of fighting to keep the world out of the churches, the modernist religious movement has let the world in. They've invited the world into the churches. And so we see this total breakdown in morality. You had the revolution of the 1960s. The invention of the pill to make free sex just that much more ubiquitous. Sex without any restraints. Abortion legalized in the early 1970s. Our modern educational system, moral relativism, situation ethics, political correctness run amok. Look at the tragedies we see today with respect to family. Abortion killing off about 1 million per year. The silent Holocaust, it's been called. That's just in the United States. And those who aren't aborted, how many are born out of wedlock? And then add in the very modern diseases of today, sicknesses, mental sicknesses, STDs, the AIDS epidemic, and then the addictions, drug and alcohol. And now, just in the last decade or two, widespread acceptance of homosexuality, homosexual marriage, and now transgenderism, of all things. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11:14, does not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it's a shame unto him? Can't you even understand this because of nature? But if a woman have long hair, it's a glory to her. This is Paul. This is the New Testament. It's glory to a woman. It says, if anyone presumes to raise objections on this point, well, I acknowledge no other mode of worship, and neither do the churches of God. That was the Apostle Paul saying. This is what God teaches. Even nature should teach this. And if you don't agree with it, well, there is no other mode of worship. There is no other mode of worship. What God says goes. But we won't listen to what God says. We won't accept what God teaches. And so here we are today, and the transformation continues right on. We entered into this world of revolt following the Great War 100 years ago. And as Joel Hilliker wrote at the Trumpet a year or two ago, he said, American morality is transforming. It continues. There's no stopping. There's no stopping this movement to utterly destroy the traditional family, marriage and family, the roles within family. He says, where will it be 5 years from now? It progressed from the traditional Judeo-Christian family to the non-religious family, to the dysfunctional family, to the divorced and remarried family, to the fornicator, to the adulterer, to the homosexual, bisexual, pansexual, transsexual, transgender. Is that where it ends? Or is there more transformation to come? What do you think? What do you think? Watch the trajectory, he says. Watch the trajectory of what's happening here. The homosexual movement has completely changed modern culture in less than a decade. People now accept and support practices they were utterly opposed to just a few years ago. Now, this deviant sexual movement is tracking in the same direction. To see where pedophiles might be in 5 years, just look at where triumphant homosexuals are today. A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to you about the spread of pornography, this Comstock Act of 1873, which banned back then, of course, the technology would have been mailing these obscene or lewd images or materials. And so there were laws in place that prevented the spread of that kind of filth. Laws that were still on the books, even as technology improved with printing in the 20th century. I read from that Politico piece that talked about the magazine Playboy with pornography and how that the laws were there to prevent that from going out. There was, even at that time, back in the 1950s, there was strong government opposition, but it wasn't strong enough. It didn't put it in its place. It's all, as I said in that program a couple weeks back, it's free speech. That trumps everything. It's got to go out because we've got freedom of speech. Well, with each new technology, it just makes it that much easier for Satan to spread that kind of filth. You'll remember, if you heard that program a couple weeks ago, what Ronald Reagan said when he was trying to prevent pornography from spreading over the phone or with television. At that time, there wasn't all this cable access, and of course, the internet wasn't around at that time. But listen to what Ronald Reagan had to say back in 1987. Here's clip two.
With this act and the implementation of the 7-point plan of the Attorney General's Pornography Commission, in which the creation of the National Obscenity Enforcement Unit is the centerpiece, this administration is putting the purveyors of illegal obscenity and child pornography on notice. Your industry's days are numbered.
He had support in his administration. He had support from everyday Americans. But do you suppose there was some... Did he win in that war against pornography? Against the purveyors of illegal obscenity? Did he win or did he lose? Did America win or did America lose? He said in that same speech, it's about time. It's about time that we get rid of this sickness, this obscenity. But we didn't get rid of it. We didn't enforce the laws that were on the books. We won't enforce the laws that are on the books with illegal immigration. We've entered into a lawless age. And look at the impact that's had on our Sodom and Gomorrah-like society. Jesus said it would be just like this. Oh, there's still a lot of eating and drinking and marrying, just like it says in Luke 17. There's still some physical prosperity left over. There's still plenty of materialism to consume. It's just as it was in the days before Lot fled Sodom and Gomorrah. Just before God rained fire from heaven. If you want proof that we're living in the last days, look at the last century. Look at the last 100 years. 100 years of the new morality. A century of the new morality. And what did Paul say in 2 Timothy 3? Verse 1, he says, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come." Dangerous times are coming in the last days. "For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good." You don't even see a natural family love. All too often, you see a lack of love even within a family unit. A love for what's yours. Your own child. Your own spouse. And children, as it says there. Children who... They don't obey their parents. Verse 14 says, "Traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God." What an apt description of our society today. Mr. Armstrong wrote in Missing Dimension and Sex, "But before we leave the world scene of the 80s, he wrote his last version of that book in 1981, hard to believe. Before we leave the world scene of the 80s, bear in mind the present world in revolt is in rebellion against much more than pre-20th century sex repression, and the modern downward spiral of humanity involves a much wider area than sex alone. It's a world in revolt, through and through. Paul says it has a form of godliness, but it denies God's power. This is what we have to turn away from. This is the world that we have to come out of. Come out from among them," God says, "and be you separate." We have a work to do in this world. We have a message to proclaim. And we have jobs and so on that we have to go out and perform and do in support of our families and in support of God's work. But as for the customs and the traditions of this world, God says, come out of it. God says, don't be influenced by it. Don't go along with it. Don't go with the flow. Missing Dimension in Sex says, since it is a basic truism that a solid family structure is the foundational bulwark of any stable and permanent society, this fact means only one thing. Civilization as we know it is on the way down and out unless that great unseen strong hand from someplace soon intervenes and saves today's sick society. It's a sick society. Read Isaiah 1. The sickness is from head to toe, God says. In the New Morality book, Mr. Armstrong says that this downward plunge, morally, is rapidly becoming a greater threat to humanity than the hydrogen bomb. So it's important from time to time that we step back and try to get some perspective and think about these past 100 years and the dramatic changes that we've witnessed, all of it proof that we're living in the very last days. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.